the agenda for the next two sessions on orders is full because it invites your full participation, so I want to get started. My name is John Schramm, and this is the second of two sessions on orders within the church and whether or not orders are a way in which the church might be renewed or be more faithful. I think it's usually good to start with some review, meaning you bring to mind some things from yesterday that stand out or that you don't have to look at notes to remember. Those are usually the things that maybe are the most important, at least for you and for your comprehension of the topic. Let's just do that with a little bit of sharing. What do you remember from yesterday about orders that either surprised you or that you thought was important?
They originally included women in third order.
Okay. Originally, they did include women, maybe started with a way in which women became fully part of the church when it was largely male-dominated, all right? Certainly started with lay people. It wasn't until which order that it was primarily clergy? The Jesuits were all clergy, but the Dominicans, you remember the letters after the Dominican order? OP, Order of Friars Preachers. That was a preaching order, all right? So it's a lay people's movement at the start. Other things?
I was intrigued by the idea that it was a radical, and that was their protest.
Okay, I put on the board what I thought was the essence after all kinds of diversity. Can you summarize some of the diversity among those things that are all called orders, the vast differences? Give me some examples.
lay involvement in one order and not in another.
Okay, whether it was predominantly lay or clergy, you could say in some orders it was this, in other orders it was that.
Centralized
or extremely diverse, with each prior or each monastery having its own life and held together basically by a common rule, but not by any common government. Good? Of offices. Okay, some were chanted, sung regularly. The major one that broke out of that, the Jesuits do not chant the divine offices, but say them privately to themselves. Okay?
Rules.
Okay, all right. Do you remember the rule of St. Benedict? Probably the primary one, but in the 12th century, a lot of people took the Augustinian rule because it was simpler. The rule that appears to us now harsh, the Benedictine or extreme, was really a very a form of stability in an otherwise chaotic world. Okay.
Different vows,
contemplative or not contemplative, hermits or, give me the other word, cenobites, means you are alone, literally alone, or alone together. The word monastery comes from monas, the Greek, or solos, the Latin, meaning alone. Okay, but that didn't necessarily say you had to either be an absolute hermit or could live in community. There were both, and they were both called orders. Okay. Good. There may be some more. Are there? Okay, the way they dressed. How about the original idea of that long robe? Was it distinctive?
No,
it made them common with the poor. It made them indistinguishable, not set them apart as extraordinarily religious, okay? In the midst of all of that, I thought the essence was that they were protest movements, and I used a word that was the summary I quoted from Bernard of Clairvaux that said, won't the world think we're playing at something? Because what they consider important, we consider unimportant, and what they consider unimportant are the things we consider important. It was a reversal of worldly values, and I finally came down to the quote from Thomas Merton, the essential quality is to stand in contradiction to the prevailing values of the world around. The others are not essential. The essential quality is that reversal of worldly values. That seems to me to be probably the most important single thing to distill from yesterday. Okay, now go down another path from yesterday. What else did you remember? Tell Eric and Dan what we did. Can you name some of the historic orders? The ones from which almost all orders have flowed, could you name them? They were on the board yesterday. What would be at the top of the list? Augustinians, okay? And they were in chronological order yesterday. That's not the only way to take it, but Augustinians next. Benedictines. Franciscan. Dominican. Those are very close, around 1200. And the Jesuits. From the Benedictines, we had two others that are very familiar that really flowed from it, but are known in their own right. Lots of others are known in their own right. Cistercians and the Trappist being a form of Cistercian. All right, good. Thomas Merton was a Trappist. Do you remember the fancy name? Cistercian of the Strict Observance. Okay, all right. What I'd like to do today is to continue the argument on the question. And the question really is before us all 3 days. I phrased it this way. Was or is, and this is an exact quote that followed the Adolf Harnack quote that says, the Protestant church was poorer for having suppressed monasticism. If you remember Janet's question, I think it was very natural that it was suppressed. And we gave some of the reasons, because Martin Luther was really revolting against aspects of the Augustinian order. I mean, when you break out of that, it's almost inevitable that you also kind of put something down just because it is, what, Catholic, just because it is of the orders, because when you broke out of that, you also tend to have a kind of wholesale putting down of the values of that. Harnack claims that we are the poorer because of that. Today, we're having a discussion that says, no, I'm not sure we're poorer. We have other ways of doing what the orders did, and they are better, or they emphasize the freedom of the gospel more. We're doing something today that I've never tried before. We're having a discussion among 20-some people. 10 of us did homework. Besides the discussion of yesterday, which was homework for all of us, 10 people here literally read in other areas and are going to take part in the discussion. They're not going to be called on for a 3-minute report, but it's not under the table that when we discuss some of these aspects, they have done some special reading on parts of Protestant discipline, movements, societies, and associations that had as their intent keeping alive a particular focus within the church or other aspects of it. Before we get to that, I'd like to have you do one more point of review, and that's put the characteristics of the orders on the board so that we're bouncing up against that every time we talk about some alternative to order. Let's compare it with the characteristics that we've said are part of an order, right? You remember, that's the last thing we did, and we did it very quickly. Can you remember them? Okay, some form of protest movement. In other words, we picked up the idea of the essence being a reversal of worldly values. Some rule, okay? Some guideline or standard that you have to bounce up against. Some not only statement of faith, but rule as to our common life. It's not only agreeing to the Augsburg Confession. It would include something like decision shall be made by consensus, or decision shall be made by an abbot and you shut up and adjust, or something in between that, right? So it's a rule for our common life. Third, vows. Some specific, particular way in which you commit yourself to the disciplines of the order and to the gospel. Fourth, a focus. Particular reason for existing, and primarily in the history of orders, to keep alive some gospel value for the whole church, but it might get lost unless one group took that as their particular reason for existence. Okay? Fifth?
Connection with others.
Okay, linked with others.
Thank you.
yesterday about all we had time to say was, when there was a community of people who lived under all of these, they were a protest movement, they had a rule, they took vows, they had a particular focus, as long as they remained a single community somewhere, they had a purpose within a church, they weren't an order until there was another group somewhere else or other people with whom they linked. That's when it became an order. Before that, it was Cenobite or hermit, so either alone or together as a kind of community, but it became an order when it was linked with others. And sixth, accountable to the church. And probably, if you have read Metz, not only accountable to the church, but integral to the structure of the church.
Accountable to the church in what way?
We used a couple examples yesterday. If you are a Lutheran Peace Fellowship, your reason for existing is to protest violence. You certainly might have a rule. It might be stated in gospel values, and also might include how you are part of a chapter. You could take some vows of tax resistance, daily prayer against the arms race, some other things. You certainly have a particular focus that you don't want to lose. You don't want the whole church to lose an emphasis on peace, and there could be chapters linked together under a common thing. It is not official. In the first answer in the brochure from Lutheran Peace Fellowship, it says, Lutheran Peace Fellowship is an independent Lutheran organization. What does that mean? It means that at the convention of the American Lutheran Church, when congregations are there to vote, Lutheran Peace Fellowship is not a recognized entity of that body. It's an independent kind of off-here movement. Do you see? So would they be accountable to the church? Well, if they bear the name Lutheran and are faithful to a common tradition, that's a form of accountability, but it's not integral into the life of the church. It's not an official part of the church. I think that's an... I don't know that I can be pressed into canon law as to the difference, but...
More or less.
We gave the story yesterday and said if you had been here for Dan's things on St. Francis, you remembered that he went to ask the Pope to recognize the order, and the Pope said, looks like you ought to feed pigs. So he did and came back the next day. We've done that. Now what, Your Holiness? But it was when it was a recognized order. All of the ones we had on the board yesterday at some point were recognized by the church as an official order of the church. When the Dominicans get acceptance of their order, of their rule, for something like 6 years they lived under the Augustinian rule, which was already accepted, and then later became more officially Dominican. So you could go back into the history of that being an important step. I had more notes yesterday than we had time. I just wanted to give you one thing that I had from yesterday that I found to be very important under vows, and very important when you read Metz, because I'm not sure he has the same view on vows that I'm going to give you from Sister Marie Augusta Neal, and then we'll move into the new material. She says that the historic vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience were at the beginning very evangelical vows. And let me give you what she said last summer when she was here. She said that, for instance, the vow of celibacy had less to do with human sexuality than it did with availability. It was a vow that said, I will not take on any primary commitment like family in order to be available to whoever needs help. It had more to do with that than some theological premise about human sexuality. She also, as she went through this at our dining room table one night, showed how quickly the original intent of the vow got turned 180 degrees away. Who was the least available? A cloistered nun or monk? I mean, at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you needed help, where would you go? The last place you would go is this walled enclosure of people whose original vow had been to availability, and now it was that they did not marry and had less to do with availability than it did with human sexuality. And I think Metz brings up more the second coming of Christ than he does availability when he gets to that vow, even though I think he has some important things to say. Poverty. She claims poverty was originally a vow of a commitment to sharing. He does have that word. I looked for that word. If you read again Metz's section on poverty, I think that's the best of his three on vows. Those five or six pages are just excellent on a vow of poverty. They really are kind of gospel instead of legalism. But if you think in terms not so much of asceticism, do you know what that means? To value the idea of mortifying and owning nothing and almost the opposite of giving thanks to God, the giver of every good and perfect gift, almost as though the gifts were an evil in themselves. Poverty, meaning I dare not own anything. If you see it more as a vow of sharing, then look where it came very quickly. She said there is a rule in a monastic order that you dare not refuse any gift that is offered to you. You must take it. But if you want to give something away, you have to get permission of the abbot. Just exact reversal of an early commitment to share all that you had. Do you see where it went quickly? Obedience. There is Metz at his best. The vow of obedience was an understanding that the primary characteristic of what it meant to be Christian was to follow Christ. Metz is best at the simplest. Over and over again, he says, no, it's follow Christ. It's a way of doing Yoder's Politics of Jesus, carrying it out as to what that would mean within the church. If you've read the Politics of Jesus, then it seems to me Metz would open up. Who is theologian, according to Metz? The one who best follows Christ. What does it take to be a teacher? It means you are a follower of Christ and share that. What's the best preaching example? So that Metz time and time again comes back to congruency is the mark of what it means. In fact, I think if you really were consistent with Metz, we would never again use Christian to describe us. We would say followers of Christ. And you have a different way of understanding who we are by using that instead of acceptance of some theology over here. It's your life follows Christ. The original vow of obedience was to follow Christ, so that it was saying in Yoder's language, yes, Jesus is normative. Soon, you had to follow the abbot or the superior, even if they asked something that was inconsistent with the gospel of Christ. That's the reversal. And that seems to me where the Reformation, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, is more consistent with the original intent of the Augustinian vow than when Luther followed the superior to the denial of the gospel. Do you catch the difference? Mary?
Well, Pastor Mike, Karen's letter when she was in Mexico said that the base community people that she was with again asked the question, she knew this, but it struck her again, instead of saying,
okay, good. Yeah, we could do, and we will have time in the next 2 days to do some of that with the other things on the board. But it seemed to me that you ought to check Sister Marie's understanding of the original vows, which to me were the most exciting description I've ever heard of the vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience, with what we're learning from Metz. And when we talk about today, when we talk about other ways in which we could be followers of Christ, not orders, let's not do an injustice to those original vows and see them as repressive. That's what I'm saying. Let's make the contribution of a movement, a society, a free association of people in the best light. Let's also have orders and those original intentions for the vows in the best light, not in the worst light. Okay. I'm going to start the other side of the coin. We will come into it at this point, and if those who have done some extra reading, when they do share, if you will also say what you read specifically so that people understand the kind of research you did, I think that'll be helpful. I'm going to give you a quote from the Brethren of the Common Life, 15th century Holland. I think this is Rule for a New Brother. The little book, I think, comes from the Brethren of the Common Life. They were asked about the absence of a rule that they had, or the absence of some of the things that were there in the historic orders. And the head of one of the communities wrote, "We are not members of an order. We are religious men trying to live in the world. If we get a papal order compelling those who leave us either to return to us or to enter another order, we shall be selling our liberty, that liberty which is the singular glory of the Christian religion, to buy chains and to buy prison walls. We won't do that. In order to fall into line and conform to religious orders, our way of life springs and has always sprung from an inner kernel of devotion. Let us therefore not bring upon ourselves at once the destruction of our good name, our peace, our quiet, our concord, and our charity. Our voluntary life as brethren is very different from the irrevocable necessity of those who live under the rule and statutes of a religious order." Does that get the Protestant blood flowing in some of you as to rebelling against what we did yesterday? All right. Question today is, don't we have alternatives to orders? If so, what are they, and do they bring the kind of life and renewal that we want in the church? Okay. What kinds of reactions do you have?
Theodore? Well, the idea of Christian community is not all a bad one. Because in that idea of people living together it's a committed way. I guess I don't see what from what I've read. The Mustard Seed Conspiracy by Tom Sinney or
Sine. I think he pronounces it Sine. S-I-N-E, isn't it? Yeah. Okay.
Elizabeth O'Connor's book, The New Community. Neither one of those really speak of the more lifelong kind of commitment. They talk of a community in which there is commitment involved. In fact, O'Connor speaks clearly of the marks of a liberating community, of the new community. Those five marks all involve the word commitment. My sense of the historic orders, though, is that it's a longer commitment, not a lifelong thing.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember the five marks that she has? That'd be important if we're going to kind of shape a community that we might want to be in, and it isn't going to be an order. To hear what some other people think are essential to a healthy community is certainly part of the discussion. Can you remember some of them?
Well, the first mark was that there's an overall concern for the poorest, the weakest, and the most abused members of the human family.
Okay.
That was number one. She talked of a radical commitment to those people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is shaped by that commitment. The other four bars kind of fall in place. There's a commitment to dialogue as opposed to just talking openly, and she explains dialogue in terms of honest disclosure and listening. There's a commitment to reflection, to examining and critiquing. There's also a commitment to contemplation, not just looking at what has been done, but deep prayerful contemplation of the scriptures and the Spirit speaking. There's a commitment to structuring in our day time of solitude. And I think there's another one.
Okay.
The first one is the one,
yeah.
Right? Or a more internal.
Okay.
Is dialogue, who's that with? Dialogue with whom?
Dialogue within the community and dialogue with the global.
With the poor?
With everybody and everything. But it's an approach of listening. It's an approach of honestly trying to engage each other in a caring, listening way, which is one more way of saying we're open to being shaped by you. And there's a commitment to all those forms, all those marks of community, but it doesn't involve the lifelong
mm-hmm.
permanency. And there's no real rule or vow, so to speak, that I don't know, they're not quite as focused down as
the order. Good start. Are there people now who feel that, do you understand the kind of format for the next half an hour, 45 minutes? What are the pros and the cons of Elizabeth O'Connor's less structured, kind of voluntary community and orders? What are the differences? And then can you feel the tension and pros and cons in each side? Not necessarily, first of all, where you would place yourself in that, but catch the issue involved. Even as Ted spoke, against the background of yesterday, what's the most glaring difference? He said it right at the end.
The stability, whether it's 1 or 2 years or a lifetime.
Or focused in a rule that says my contemplation is not whether I have time that day or not. Contemplation here is 7 times a day whether you feel like it or not. That's a big difference. All right. Aren't there pros and cons to both sides of that? When you pray when you don't have to and it takes away the spontaneity, that's one thing. When I've said for 50 years I want to have a disciplined prayer life and still don't have it, that ought to tell me something about this business of I want to be free. If I never pray, that's the other side of the coin, right? Okay, so just when something like Ted's report on the reading he did comes up against yesterday, just jump in. Okay, I will jump in now, I hope not at all, or at least a lot less if the conversation gets going. Yes, Marilyn.
You said if there weren't already existing movements or organizations within Protestantism that would mean that we didn't need orders.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think of some of those organizations, like Pax Christi, mm-hmm. within the Catholic Church, which isn't an order, but it's a group of people concerned and committed to peacemaking, Lutheran Peace Fellowship, Presbyterians for Peace, as I think of just taking for now the example of a number of these Christian peace organizations, what they don't have that orders have is a way to call each other to begin to embody what they are saying. In some ways they can become admiration societies for Jesus, and in terms of what Meth says, that we're not called to admire but we're called to embody, and that's where our words and our speaking can only come after we begin the embodiment. So it seems like these organizations are helpful, but they don't really provide a living, earthy example of, you know, a foretaste of the feast to come.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about that, but it's not really getting around to showing how that could be done among a community of people, which is what can be very hope-inducing for people who are seeing that and can be very attractive. And they can also lean towards criticism rather than having the critique and embodying a response.
Okay.
So that seems, in the reading I was doing, which was on the Community of the Ark, which is a Gandhian order, that's what the originator of the community, Lonzo Del Vasto, went to visit Gandhi in the 1930s and came back committed to begin a Gandhian order in the West. And he chose that name, came out of a Catholic tradition, so I think that was very much a part of his choice of the word order. But their community is marked by vows, and the first vow is to nonviolence in personal relationships, interpersonal life, on a national scale, to participate nonviolently in the politics of one's country, and to perceive oneself as part of a global reality. And that takes concrete forms of a commitment to, in terms of conflict within the community, I think this is one of the most profound things that they do, is that when someone is not living up to their vows or their commitments within the community, which they recite to each other every evening around a bonfire if it's raining indoors, then they kind of use Matthew as the Matthew text about confronting one-on-one first, but instead then of going to another community member and saying, okay, so-and-so's not paying any attention to the issue I brought up to them, let's go and talk to them together, that person instead will take on a penance. For example, if you all do make a commitment to working 6 hours a day out in the fields, if someone is not doing that, then what you do in noticing that one of your brothers or sisters isn't living up to that commitment, you take on their work. So that the way of bringing people to sharpen the fact that they're not living up to the commitments is to, as unobtrusively as possible, take on whatever they are not doing. And so that it becomes then very much personalized, and that person has to face the fact that you are bearing the burden that they're not, that they aren't willing to carry. There are a lot of other vows and things that mark that community. That just occurs to me as an example for now.
Do you think on the basis of yesterday that they do have the marks, so that he was right in saying a Gandhian order? It sounds like.
Yes, they have a 3-year apprenticeship, and then the whole community has to have consensus that a person, that they think that they are ready to live as a person of the Ark. And then as they decide in consensus, then it is a lifetime commitment. So that commitment of stability for life marks them.
What did you read?
I read Return to the Source, which is a book on Del Vasto's pilgrimage to India to see Gandhi. And then I've read another of Del Vasto's books. It's a collection of his writings. And then I have a friend who spent 2 weeks in the community of the Ark in France. And he told me his experience of their daily life.
If you like journal kind of writing of someone's pilgrimage, Return to the Source is one of my favorite books. The Society of the Ark is a fascinating group. I once in a while would go back when Holden was frustrated with consensus and give you the example of Del Vasto in D.C. saying, no, we always arrive at consensus. And when someone didn't believe him, no, what if you have a disagreement? He said, no, you always arrive at consensus. And they didn't understand him until he said, well, one time we fasted for 28 days. That's a commitment to consensus, right? No. Somebody else had a hand up. Yeah. Mary.
I think we were sitting out in front of the church last Sunday in Seattle, probably able to see 5 churches around on top of the car, wondering why with so many buildings and so much power, so little was being done in the world. And I think a lot of it has to do with accountability, which we really miss in the Protestant church in a sense. You don't have to say to anyone or to be confronted by them about anything that you do or don't do.
Okay. Spence.
This is the thing that I've been thinking through, and Marilyn brought up with some of the organizations like Pax Christi or Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And I say this coming out of, I realize I claim my Roman Catholic tradition around here a lot, sort of as a thorn in the flesh, but I'm much more Protestant in the way I live out in my training. But I'm coming to believe that the what we often hear about is Protestant freedom, the freedom to do things the way the Protestants do, is really an illusion. I really question whether freedom can operate outside of the context of responsibility or commitment and accountability. And that's what I think that the orders bring that the other things don't. And I think we end up, I know I end up kidding myself. I think we all end up kidding ourselves that we think, no, we'll claim the freedom to do it the way we want to and decide when we want to do it and not want to do it. And think that we can still have, if that is freedom, in these kind of commitments.
Does that freedom have to come from a lifelong commitment to a specific order?
I don't know, but
I can see a lifelong commitment to the faith, but to the institutions?
Well, this is, I guess you have to define what the church is, but I have the hardest time for myself with accountability. It's very tempting for me to just say, well, forget everybody else, I'm right, and I don't care what they think anymore, because you get so frustrated just beating your head against the wall. But I really, when I get to that point, then I really, that's where I think some of the danger is.
Okay. Dean and Janet. Dean was first.
One of the questions I'm struggling with, too, is the reference to Spence's thing. If you connect yourself with the institutional church, and I see the institutional or the structured church in many places, not generally, like let's say in wherever, but that particular structure of the church is in essence dying, in my own words, using my own words. Why connect yourself, be accountable to an institution and a structure that in your own mind and in the minds of the community that you're trying to form is dying?
So you question six.
Yeah,
okay.
I really do.
Okay.
Is it wise to connect yourself in a very direct fashion to a structure that is dying. Is the renewal of that structure going to happen, or is it going to die? I'm struck by Metz's thing having to do with ars mortendi, the art of dying.
Mm-hmm.
Does, for instance, an order, a community, start with the idea that we will be serving a need for a specific period of time and then we will die? I don't hear any of that. I hear, we're going to start this committee and it's going to go on forever. I don't think that's realistic because they die all the time. Why not structure things so that if needs are met, that can phase out? That it doesn't become institutionalized within itself. That it serves a need, that it has a function, and then that function can change.
Or is it accountability life? Is there a
I'm not sure, but I rebel at the idea of hooking the team directly accountable to a dying, what I see is a dying structure, a constricting dying thing. How can you receive nourishment, how can you receive direction from that kind of an institution? Just a question.
I'm going to pose a question for the first time. You who studied communities, there were a couple books, Kantner book and New Community, what have you, and Taisei. Do you have a sense of whether or not the healthiest ones are the ones who expect to live forever or the ones that have within them a kind of art of dying and do not spend time on self-preservation? In other words, is it inevitable, if you expect to last a long time, that the primary choices you'll make are your self-preservation rather than, like, giving and serving? And are there any... Yes, go ahead.
I find that a lot in Pustinia, and Catherine Desfourc, mm-hmm. But it's like, she just went out and she started with the basic call, you know, give all your possessions away to the poor and follow me. And she never even planned on starting a community. She just went out among the poor. And so there wasn't any an idea of an institutional structure or even a community. But then people started coming to her. And as long as people, you know, still felt that need of what she focused on silence and solitude, but also availability and hospitality. And people came. And even it started out as a lay movement, but then now I think it's 14 or 15 priests are also a part of that now. And it's like people come because they see it as a source of renewal. They see it as a source of refreshment. And I haven't seen at all that the focus at all has been on trying to maintain it simply to maintain it, but only because it's an expression of the workings of the Spirit as they see it. So I see that as being important.
Janet, yours wasn't on that when you had your hand up before. Yeah, Sue.
The book that I read was Kindergarten Community, and so much of that talked about communities that were just solely there for themselves. You know, they weren't doing anything for the poor or anything like that. They would welcome in, to a certain extent, new members, but they didn't do a lot of outreach work. And definitely in those, the ones that survived the longest were the ones that were concerned with, you know, a certain commitment from their members, sacrifice from their members, you know, and that was enough, and the future of trying to prevent things, you know, and all these things that the members had to go through. And the ones that were the most structured were the ones that lasted the longest. I don't know how much that really applies, mm-hmm. to the, you know, some type of movement or order that would be trying to do work out in the world. But on what Dean is saying too about being accountable, I guess I have problems with that too, because I guess if there really is a commitment, I think a lot of times accountability will stifle the work that you feel committed to do. If you feel like you have to be answering to someone or doing certain things the way a certain institution or whatever wants them done, a lot of times it seems, or it would seem to me, that it would stifle spontaneous work, because every situation is so different.
Janet, you want to come into that?
Yeah, I'm going to devil's advocate because my sense of that prevailing established commitment is that it can be, for someone who's self-motivated, the link or the bond of holding someone accountable, but it can also set up a whole structure that is not much different than society's, that keeps us as passive, not having to think of initiative or things to do, sets up a system whereby we can just fulfill these things and we don't have to feel bad, we can probably feel pretty good. And I'm not sure that that's really accountability. I'm not sure that if you buy into a structure that is that established, that it serves a purpose of accountability.
You're disagreeing with Spence? Okay. I'll give you time to come back. Go ahead.
Maybe, I guess part of it is defining what we mean by the church or what we're being accountable to. And maybe if I take us outside of the United States context first, I think it's applicable within the United States, but what I most clearly saw was in the church in Latin America, the Catholic Church was a very hierarchical home where people really do have accountability to the institution. But where I saw the accountability being played out was in the church itself, I mean the people who were in it, especially the poor. And what I really ended up finding was sort of a certain elitism among people that opted out of being accountable to the church because they knew they were enlightened now and didn't need and knew that that church wasn't where it was at and didn't need to deal with it. I especially got with my Marxist friends there. I was working with very poor refugees in El Salvador, and my Marxist friends had an assumption that they would work with these people, but once these people became enlightened, they wouldn't need the church anymore. And I found it really arrogant that we would have that kind of understanding towards people that were involved in the church, and our accountability was only as far as getting them out rather than learning from them. And I found that when I had re-questioned my easy enlightenment about how corrupt the church was, how dying it was as an institution stuff, that I found a tremendous amount of light in the church, not where I expected to find it, but that was where my accountability was, and I saw that accountability in these Christian communities, priests working with that, who still had to maintain some kind of accountability to the institution, but saw beyond the institutional deadness to finding a real church that was alive. I think it's harder for us to see that in our society, especially with our context of individualism, but I think it's there too. The minute I really get frustrated with the church and want to leave it, I really have to question whether I'm being elitist as far as people who are still in the church, who is very important for them, and am I just arrogantly thinking I have something that they don't? So I guess that's why I bring in accountability.
I can see what you're saying, but it's almost to me like you've defeated your own argument just by using base communities as an example, because those, to me, are very distinct from an order.
But if you listen to them, though, I mean, so I'm talking about accountability as far as, I guess I was thinking of clergy who are in orders, and that's where their accountability is lying, but they are very, very emphatic on the point that they are not a separate church, that they are not a withdrawal movement from the church, that they are within the church, that they are the church. And I guess if I keep that, no, but I'm not saying, and I was not part of the base Christian community, but many of the priests, you know, the Jesuits and so forth that I worked with who were in orders, that was where their accountability lay. And I think that the orders that I've seen in the Catholic Church in Latin America have just tremendous prophetic witness because of their accountability and their commitment and their focus. That's what I've experienced. I have it. It's been harder for me with the Protestant churches in Latin America because every missionary is his or her own castle, sort of. They're all very isolated little things. I don't get the sense of connectedness.
We got Jean had her hand up. Dan has his hand up. Mike, Dean, Eric, let's go in that order. That's the order I saw them in. Jean.
Where I'm connecting with Spence in that is that maybe where Dean and I might differ on this is that, I mean, I still want to see hope for the church. I don't want to just say that it is a dying institution or that it is dead somehow, but rather I'd see the positiveness of that accountability to the church would be that the orders in themselves aren't to take on sort of a life of their own separate from the church, but to actually be a source of renewal for the church, to be something for the church itself to be bouncing off, as well as that the orders are to bounce off the church. And so, in that case, I would I would see the positiveness of that. I wouldn't want to see them just be splintered off from the church.
That's Metz's primary appeal to the superiors of these orders, to that function. I think Dean questions that some, but okay. Dan, and then, well, the same order.
Well, I was just thinking briefly, I think through history you can find example after example of little splinter groups that have left the church, and then they decide they're the true church for the true believers, and then you have a sect, and then that group will split. A few people are split from that group that are better than that group. I just think the accountability just somehow preserves groups from that happening. And it's largely maybe the cause of a lot of denominationalism in the past.
Eric?
I guess I have some problems with the accountability because it so often seems to become accountability to an institution rather than accountability to the people you're supposedly serving. And I just, you know, you see the examples of where Catholic priests are told, no, you cannot be involved in social service leadership role in the community or whatever, because that is against the tenets of the church or the vows of the priesthood. And at that point, it becomes so destructive, because it seems like you've removed yourself from what you originally set yourself as your goal. You are becoming an organization or an institution rather than the service coming primary. Rather than being a service organization, you are becoming an organization and then service coming after your group has been built. So the accountability part, God, I would hope there'd be some way that people could just act. Here's my naive. But I would hope that people could just act rather than having to be browbeat into it by some hierarchy.
Dean and Mike, are you on this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Still.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
that's something caught my ear when Jan was talking about when you begin, and also Eric, I guess when you say accountability is becoming like an organization, and that then it becomes a passive form of life, as you said, something like that. Is that individually or organizationally, or
both?
Or both. I saw a show on TV last year, a couple hours long, on the Trappist monks. They had an interview with a dozen of the monks there, ranging from people that have been there for a long time to some fairly recent ones. And some are really vocal and some weren't. And it covered every aspect of the life of the Trappist monks. And what I saw there was that they were all accountable, and yet they all had strong daily struggles with their order, their life, their beliefs, their basic beliefs even, and that vocalization showed that they were not just a bunch of mindless men walking around, and that they were passive in their thinking at all, that they were really active in questioning daily their existence, and yet they still obeyed, and that is the obedience to they were obedient, they had the vow of obedience made them accountable. And I'm not sure that accountability has to connote irresponsibility, that it doesn't face up to the realities of the world.
Okay. Dean?
I'll pass.
Okay. Is there, Mary?
Well, I guess I was thinking of accountability more in line not up to a hierarchy or an institution or to the people that we work with, but accountability to one another. If we're talking about communities, there has to be accountability to one another or you don't have an entity. Community of Christ had six disciplines that we re-upped every 6 months, so there was no dead wood. And the reason for that, and it sounded like legalism to some, but it said to the other people, you can count on me to do this for a 6 month period of time. Then we made it a year re-enlisted if you want to get that.
it was a way of saying, whatever we do in ministry in this neighborhood, you can count on me to be here or to do this or to retreat with you or to hold your prayer for you or whatever it was for the next 12 months. And that was very freeing because you didn't have to wonder if so-and-so was going to be there or if you could ask them to do something. It was just an assumption.
Sue and Spence, I think, was the order it came in.
I guess, along with what Eric was saying, when I think of accountability and I think of commitment, I guess if I see that there's, when I was thinking of commitment as committing to a group or community, whatever, that's more of an ideal, a commitment to a total ideal to me rather than a certain amount of time or a certain this and that, and this will be your job and you will do these things. I guess I see if there's a commitment to an ideal, accountability doesn't. I think I have a different interpretation.
Okay. Accountability is my word, and I said this was the hardest one for me to describe, although I think maybe Gene did it better in the Metz book. The assumption in the Metz book that the orders are clearly integral within have as part of their assumption the renewal of the whole church. They haven't written off the church. If accountability includes being controlled by, I think that's where the order has more freedom than maybe you're giving it credit for, because I use the word accountable or because yesterday didn't cover the history. There's a strange tension between the freedom that some movement might have and yet being fully part of the structure, almost in but not of. And I don't know how to say that well, but
I think there's a real contrast or an undermining between 1 and 6.
Yeah.
In my own mind.
Okay.
If you're going to be in protest,
keep going.
He didn't mean you couldn't speak. He was just.
Well, I hope not. But when I look at accountability, that word, and being integral part of the church, and I look at being a protest, a reversal, really practically speaking, in an American culture, those are just don't. There's just all sorts of conflict that you're setting yourself up for. You know, in my own mind, in the church, in our country. Go ahead.
Spencer, would you like to speak?
I'm speaking first to Eric and also to Dean. I think that's precisely the point. That's where the creative tension comes out of, is that tension between 1 and 6. I mean, it's when the priests get told by the Pope you can't be a representative. It's when the priests get told but you can't be in Nicaraguan government, that you get the conflict, that you get the dialogue in the church that leads to some kind of renewal or some kind of having to work through these issues. It's not when we split off and avoid them that we are able to work through them at all. And I think that's why I'm so much reattracted to Catholicism today, because there's so much creative conflict and fervor going on in the Catholic Church right now. It's just a mess, but it's really exciting. Because there's constant tension between 1 and 6. And granted, we hear mostly about the most dramatic cases, like the Jesuits who are directly under the Pope, but there are other orders that can do this without having to sacrifice all their ideals to the accountability. But I'm just finding it's in that tension. It's when I have to say, okay, I made a commitment, even though this is where I feel really strongly, I'm going to have to step back and think about it and talk stuff through. But that's where it performs that renewing function that Metz is talking about. I mean, the whole Catholic Church all the way around the world now is talking about the priests and the Nicaraguan government. What does it mean to be a church of the poor? We always thought it meant to be a spiritual church. Is that what it means? So, yeah, maybe some of those priests are going to have to step back and not be able to take that function, but that renewing function is just really exciting.
So you see renewal actually coming out of conflict.
Oh, yeah.
And differences.
I don't see how you can
avoid it. Rather than anything other than that. Well, that's the major cutting edge.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to make that explicit. I don't know how you avoid the conflict.
Eric has a question. Look at Eric.
Did you say that the priest then should just step back from the function and stay with the church? I mean, that's like...
I'm not going to make a blanket rule. No, I'm not going to make a blanket rule because I think Martin Luther did a very... Martin Luther
no,
is a classic...
No, but you would even say that that's good.
Can I just finish? Martin Luther, I think, was in the same context that we find in Nicaragua today. He was faced with that. I mean, he did that. He performed that tension between 1 and 6. And he didn't. It was not his intention to leave the church. The church put an ultimatum, made him leave, basically. That may happen today. I mean, there's always that risk. And I'm not going to say that there's a blanket answer for each situation, but if you avoid the situation, you avoid any opportunity for the renewal. If we just become real nice little free individuals who decide when and where we're going to opt in and opt out, I just think that is a total cop-out.
I'm not sure that you are understanding one another, no. Connecting. Ask it again, Eric.
The tension is fine. It just is that I would say that when it comes between following the gospel and taking the function and maintaining the discipline of the church or the institution, I would tell the institution to go shop.
Well, that's part of it, although I'm increasingly very leery about my ability as an individual to always know the gospel. So I guess the accountability, I'm not saying that, I'm not excluding accountability, that's only to the institution. The institution's part of that, but certainly for me it's not the major part. There's a church in there.
That's a good clarification.
Yeah,
Ted and then Dan, go ahead.
That's a real important clarification. If you're accountable in the community or in to each other, as opposed to just accountable to institutional dogma or whatever, that needs to be clarified. One idea of making a commitment is a reversal of worldly values. Because the world does not do that very often. At least not very well.
Dan.
We Protestants, too, have such a different concept of the church than Roman Catholics. I mean, to us, it's an institution with Crumley or Preuss sitting in their office. Anything that was founded in the 16th century, that a Roman Catholic has a sense that Christ founded the church and gave the church to the apostles. You know, the apostles carried on the tradition, so you don't just say, well, this is an institution. Didn't Dorothy Day once said she'd even close down her entire operation if the bishop...
That's correct.
And that's...
Dorothy Day said she would stop the Catholic worker movement if the bishop said she had to stop.
And we Protestants don't understand that.
No, sure don't. I mean, that if...
I don't understand it, I don't agree with it.
Yeah, right. But it's, I guess what we're saying is it would be worthwhile finding out a little bit more of why she would say that. Go ahead, Jane. Well, then Rick. Pardon?
That's just said a little bit when he said that he wonders about himself as an individual always being a contributor to the gospel.
Uh-huh. Right. Rick?
Well, I was thinking we're accountable at six, but in essence we're accountable to the rule. Is accountability to the focus? And there's accountability to the balance. It seems like we're kind of creating
that. Okay, the reason I added six was, could not a community have accountability within itself, have a focus, have vows, everything else? I'm talking about connection with the Church Catholic, with our roots and our history. Instead of the Protestant way would be to form a new denomination or a sect or freedom, and this is a dimension that I have up here specifically, because if you read Metz and understand the history of the orders, they would not just kind of write off the tradition and the linking with a global reality called the body of Christ. And so the discussion is exactly, it's called for partly by the tension here and partly because of where we're coming from as Protestants. Ted.
Well, then you get a Jim Jones situation.
If there
isn't, we have a common holding each other in dialogue.
Jim Jones. He's Jonestown People's Church. Okay. There were a couple other hands up a minute ago, and I'm not. Yeah.
It's like it's one thing to be accountable, say, to a church that has a history of almost 2,000 years. But accountability to two or 300-year church, or, I mean, I can, in one sense, I can see what Dean's talking about, because if you're trying to be accountable to just a dead church, when I went out last week, I attended my first Roman Catholic service. I was looking their bulletin. I was in, this is in my home area, over in Grace Harbor County, Mason County. I was amazed at the Catholic community with the mental health services they had, all the stuff they would have, I just couldn't believe the services they were offering to the poor, what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's one thing to be held accountable to a church that is still alive. But it's another thing to be held accountable to a church that is basically is dead, or is almost dead. So we look at the Roman Catholic Church, but most of us are Protestants.
Protested against a very alive church.
The other side of that is that, like, when Francis went to the Pope, that was the most dead, the most corrupt, the most fallen, probably time of the institutional church in history.
Okay, so St. Patrick succeeded. How many others have failed? Done that.
Well, does that mean we
shouldn't
try, though?
It's not we shouldn't try, but I think there should be an element of discretion about where we put our energies. Maybe we have a chance to go to a live church. I'm not advocating we all become Roman Catholics, but it's like, I don't think there's a blind, we don't have to be committed to the existing institution that we're involved with. And it seems to be because the ultimate accountability is not to the church, it's to God. And the way we carry that out, and that's the ultimate accountability. Most of the time, that does work for the church. But it's not a blind, absolutely, that the accountable to the existing church we're in.
Okay. Janet?
I just feel a real contradiction in what you're saying, because to me, you can't make a distinction between the church Catholic and the church Roman Catholic, the church Protestant. You can't pick and choose what you just see as alive for today and say, I'm going to plug in there. Because if we really believe that our accountability to God is to God, my sense is that if I really believe accountability is to God, then it is also to be played out in this world, and that church cannot be compartmentalized into Catholic, Roman, Protestant. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to be involved with every institution, but if there is a church on earth, it's not Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Lutheran. It's the church is not a dying institution here and not a dying institution there.
Well, where would you plug in?
Are you going? Is the way?
I just don't think there's two different churches that you can choose from.
Oh, where would you plug in?
I have trouble
in?
With that.
She can plug in wherever
she wants. I can plug in. I'm plugging where I find myself.
That's what I'm saying.
No, but...
What I'm saying is, just because I'm a Lutheran or a Methodist, and I'm coming with people who are trying to form a movement or an order or something, I don't think we automatically have to choose that institution we're with.
Oh,
no. That's what I'm saying. And we don't have to. That would mean, where I'm born is just where I got to stay almost. Yeah.
To me, you can't say, well, this institution that I grew up with is a dying institution, and consider that institution is synonymous with the church.
What I'm saying is, if I see the institution as dying, is not meeting my needs, not being able to carry out what I want to work with, and I see another institution that can, and I feel called by God to go with the other institution, then... Yeah, do it. And that's the ultimate accountability then, is to God and is to the living church. The living church and institutionalized church are not always the same.
Okay.
So there's
a couple things going on, which is fine. One would be where we plug in. We've asked the question the first day a little more theoretically. And what we're doing is moving toward tomorrow, when it's not theoretical at all, but we're really talking about how do we live in community, what kind of community, or what kind of church for us is the most faithful. If you'd let me ask it, though, more theoretically, which was where we were with Spence and some other discussions. Does it build health to not only allow but encourage loyal opposition? That's my understanding of the Pope saying yes to an order was building in the court jester, the town clown, the devil's advocate in court, or do you make it that if you really disagree, you've got to get out? Or do you build in the tension Spence was talking about? Protestantism does not do that well because you just start another denomination rather than hassle the conflict. Does that state it back here kind of theoretically? I mean, it is a personal question for us, but maybe sometimes it helps to see where the tension is historically or denominationally. Yeah, Marilyn.
I think maybe it sounds in our conversation like we're trying to find the answer to that question.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it seems like it's a lot, it's much more complex than that, and that it's more of a both and. That there are times like the German Confessing Church movement,
yep.
which was a time when they decided the institution that says it is the church in our society has really stepped so far away from the gospel that the only thing to do is to have a counter movement, or to say that is not the church, that is not the gospel. So that is an example of stepping out of it, a group of people doing that. We can probably all think of individuals who've chosen to step out of, you know, a specific situation in their church or whatever, where they decided, I have to leave this. And for them, that was appropriate. Maybe for another person, the very same situation, that would have been an act of copping out, which is another word that's been floating around here. So it seems that a lot of it is deciding who we are mm-hmm. and what is... what would be creative conflict and what would not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I think that Rick was clarifying that somewhat, if someone's really becoming convinced that you cannot do what you're called to do within the community you're a part of and feel called to another one, then, I mean, I think we have to listen to that and take that seriously. But also take it seriously when people say, I need to stay. You know, I have a friend who's, she's a Roman Catholic. She's studying to be a priest. She says, I need to stay. She's at Notre Dame. She's going crazy. She, you know, all of that stuff. But she keeps saying, I know I belong here. So, you know, I have to listen to people in all these different situations and kind of trust that they're being called into an accountability in their own unique way in some sense.
We've got about 5 minutes. I do want Dan to read a quote from Luther on his image of something within the church that certainly invites people to be loyal Lutherans and have their own kind of community within the church before we go to tomorrow. But Sue, what? Go ahead.
That's why I guess what I'm putting around was saying, I like, for me, I would rather think of commitment to an ideal, a commitment to, you know, the church, not as the institutionalized church, but, you know, our faith. The whole church on earth, and I would rather call it a commitment than call it accountability, because it seems to go along with what Marilyn was saying, and it seems to be the general consensus with people. I guess accountability to me says more like you have to do it, or you'll be checked up on. And you have to, but that's just what
it's about. Mm-hmm. Okay.
She's so American. We as individuals don't like to be checked up on.
But Henry David Thoreau came out of that kind of a conscience too. I mean, sometimes we've needed those lonely figures who would say that.
But yeah,
it's a danger in our
culture. I agree with a lot of what you said, but I'm for myself, because my attention is always, I always like to commit myself to ideals. But if the church is made up of real hurting people, I think now I want to commit myself to those people and not to an ideal church. Because I tend to get disillusioned and burned out when I commit myself to ideals.
Yeah, that's going to be with us again tomorrow. That's still, there are some disagreements, and there's also some use of words. I'm not sure there's clarity so that we understand the disagreements, which would be a good discussion yet, but I think we're still... But anyway, as introduction to tomorrow's agenda, I'd like Dan to read Luther's words, which are...
Well, I have them outlined, I think,
okay.
It's a little easier to read, but when in 1526, when Luther was writing on the liturgies of the Reformation churches, he really had two orders. One was the Latin Mass and the other was the German Mass. Both of these are for what we've been talking about, kind of the masses of the whole organized church. The Latin Mass more for the academic community, the German Mass more for the quote common people. But at that time, he also dreamed of what he called the evangelical order, or a third order of worship, which comes very close to what I think we're talking about here as oral orders. But I'll just read. I listed eight characteristics, and then the actual writing of Luther, I Xerox them if anybody wants to add that to your file on orders. But for the third kind of service will be a gathering, not in a public place, but will be a house church, which is modest in size and without publicity. Those who gather will be those who want to be Christians in earnest and who profess the gospel with hand and mouth. That's Luther's term, hand and mouth, meaning your whole life. Those who participate in this order of service will sign their names, should be a form of vow, as a testimony that they want to be Christians in earnest. Then this small house church will do the following: pray, read, which meant biblical study, baptize, share the Eucharist, do Christian works, and share benevolent gifts to be willingly distributed to the poor according to 2 Corinthians 9. Then five, the group will practice the rule of Christ outlined in Matthew 18, the way of dialogue resulting in reproof and reconciliation and excommunication in extreme cases. The liturgy will not be elaborate, but brief and neat, centering on the word, prayer, and love. The group will participate in a catechization based on the Creed, the Ten Commandments, and the Our Father. And the eighth, I think, is especially interesting in how now it relates to the whole church or the church of the masses. The worship services for the broad population, Latin Mass and German Mass, are intended to bring forth Christians who will earnestly love the Word and then will find each other and join together in the evangelical order, or the small house church. And then Luther closes with why he won't do this. One, he's afraid it will become a sect that's based on his needs. And then finally he says the Germans won't be able to pull it together because they are rough, rude, and reckless people. But while it never happened, it certainly was a vision and a dream that Luther had. But if you want a copy of the actual
Pass those around. My dream and vision for tomorrow will be shaped by your reaction or attempt at consensus in the next 45 seconds.